So yeah, welcome everybody. Just like to repeat Vajratara's welcome to people who've just joined us, this group. And well done for everybody, actually, because it's a horrible night. I'm amazed to see so many people here. So well done. So just because there are some people who haven't been to these Tuesdays before, I'd just like to sort of recap a little bit before we start about what we're doing. We're running a course which will be quite a long course. They tend to be a bit sort of open-ended. So quite a long course on where we're looking at Buddhism through stories and symbols and images. So that's not a sort of way of dumbed-down Dharma where we're looking at, you know, picture book Dharma. We're not doing it for that reason. If we want to make changes in ourselves that go deeper than the sort of superficial level, then we have to engage not just our surface rational minds, we have to engage our depths, we have to engage our emotions and our deep volitions, and we have to sort of activate potentials and resources in ourselves that maybe we're not usually aware of, not usually in touch with. So if we're going to access our depths in that way, we need to speak the language of the depths. And the language of the depths is poetry, symbol, myth, story. So Buddhism, what we call the Dharma, very much speaks two languages. It very much speaks the language of reason. It can be very rational, lists, ordered. It can be very, very rational indeed. But it also speaks the language of the depths, because it needs to, if we're going to sort of respond from our depths. So it also speaks the language of poetry, symbol, and myth. And there can be a tendency in the West where we tend to be a bit over-intellectual, actually, a bit over-emphasize the intellectual, to think, well, the Buddhism that comes to us through the language of reason is that's right, that's the real sort of thing. And the rest is just some sort of degeneration or some sort of concession to popularism or something. That's rubbish. That's just complete rubbish. It needs to speak both languages. Nobody's going to get anywhere just with the top 2 inches of their head. So we're going to use both languages in this series of talks. We're going to be looking at symbol, myth, story. So we're going to be hopefully engaging our depths a bit. But we're going to be unpacking those sometimes in a quite rational manner. We're going to be explaining them. And we're going to be bringing in Dharma teachings, which are, you know, from the other language as well. So that's the overall theme of this series of Tuesday nights since September. So what we've done so far, we've been doing that since September, for those of you who haven't been here. And what we've looked at so far, we started out looking at Buddhism's, one of the great symbols of Buddhism, for the problem, if you like, our existential situation. The problem of being an unenlightened human being, which is the great symbol of that, is the wheel of life. So we've been looking at the wheel of life. The wheel of life symbolizes the ultimate vicious circle, and we looked at that over a number of weeks. And we saw that it explains how, if we're not careful, unless we do something about it, the way we've been conditioned in the past, our past self, our past conditioning, determines how we act in the present, and the way we experience things in the present. And then the way we act in the present creates the person we are in the future, which becomes the person in the past who determines the... And we end up in a complete vicious circle, where the past determines the present, determines the future, and so we go on. We're on automatic pilot. We don't have any choices. We just dig our ruts deeper and deeper. We live our life without sort of consciously choosing the sort of person we wish to be, just sort of becoming what the past has made us, deeper and deeper and deeper level. So we saw how the wheel of life sort of looks at that in quite a lot of detail. It shows us some of the places we can go, good or bad, if we're following this vicious circle. It explains the mechanism by which that happens. It tells us how to get out of it. So it's quite a complex symbol, and it also explains the sort of what drives that wheel. So at the centre of the wheel of life, there are these three animals: the pig, the cock, and the snake. representing greed, hatred and delusion. And so the idea is that as long as greed, hatred and delusion, it'd be better to call them attraction, aversion, and the sort of delusion that makes us think we can get what we want all the time and avoid what we don't want. And what it's symbolizing really is that if we live our life by grasping after what gives us a pleasant feeling and shying away from or pushing away what gives us a negative feeling, an uncomfortable feeling, then we will just be on automatic pilot. We have to just override that sort of knee-jerk reaction. Otherwise, we'll be on automatic pilot. So that's what we looked at first, was the wheel of life. And then we turned to the great symbol of, if you like, the solution, the great symbol of enlightenment, which is the Buddha. So we looked at the Buddha's life in some detail. We looked at the Buddha as a symbol, just the image of the Buddha as a symbol. And we saw how that is the sort of, if you like, the great symbol of the enlightened mind in Buddhism. And we particularly looked, then we sort of expanded that out, because enlightenment's quite a big thing to look at just as one symbol. And we saw that this sort of, you can get at different, or Buddhist art gets at different aspects of enlightenment by showing the Buddha in different, with different gestures, different, what are called mudras. So we saw how the Buddha is sometimes shown with the earth-touching mudra, touching the earth. It's called calling the earth to witness. It's a bit like, I belong here. I have come from this planet. I've come from nature. I've evolved from this. It's like calling nature to witness. So that sort of ultimate groundedness in reality. So that mudra, which I can't display to you, which is simply reaching down and touching the earth, calling the earth to witness. And then we saw another one, which is a gesture of giving, a gesture of generosity, very much part of the enlightened mind, to be generous, generative, giving. A gesture of meditation we looked at, described as holding the universe in our hands. And we looked at the gesture of fearlessness. We saw how spiritual development conveys fearlessness, gives us fearlessness, a bit of unstoppability. So that's what we've been looking at so far. So we looked at the big symbol of the problem and the big symbol, if you like, of the solution, the wheel of life and the Buddha. Tonight we're going to start looking at, and we're going to look at another symbol of enlightenment. I should say before that if you want to, the CDs for all of these talks back to September are in the library for those that want them, which is why I've got this funny thing around my neck. So they're all recorded. So if you want to find out what we've done so far, the CDs are there. But tonight we're going to look at a symbol of enlightenment. We're going to look at something called the stupa. What is it? What does it communicate? What does it symbolize? And how can it help us practice, especially in meditation? So that's what we're going to look at tonight. So what is it? Well, I'll build up to that slowly. First of all, a bit of historical context, okay? So I said before that the Buddha is like the big symbol of enlightenment in Buddhism. But for at least 400 years after the Buddha's death, there were no images of the Buddha made whatsoever. Might have been longer, actually. The earliest ones I've seen are about 1st century of the Christian era, so it makes them sort of 500 years after the Buddha. So no images of the Buddha for hundreds of years. And this is probably because of some things the Buddha said. The Buddha said, for example, "He who sees me by my body does not see me." He was very hot on, well, don't relate to me as just this chap. You know, well, I don't know what he looked like. None of us know what he looked like. Big nose, I don't know. I mean, he must have been, by the time he was 80, which was when he died, had been tramping the roads of northern India, living on whatever he was given and sleeping in the open air. He might not have looked that prepossessing. But maybe that didn't matter. You know, so to relate to the Buddha as what his body looked like, he was saying, would be a mistake. He was saying, well, if you want to relate to me, relate to enlightenment, relate to the enlightened mind, relate to what I tap into. That's what's important. It's the teachings that are important, and it's what those teachings point towards that's important. It's enlightenment that's important. It's the enlightened state. It's the enlightened mind. It's not what I look like. So the Buddha was very, very keen on that. And so when we don't actually know what the Buddha looked like, because nobody made any images of him for hundreds of years, when we see pictures of the Buddha now, they're not images of a particular human being, a particular physical body. They're attempts to convey a state of mind. They're attempts to convey a state of being. So the Buddha said that he who sees me by my body doesn't see me. The state of enlightenment, the state of the enlightened mind is what's important, not the particular human being who manifests it. Enlightenment is inconceivable. Inconceivable. Inconceivable really means what it says. If you think you can conceive it, you're wrong. If you think you've got some, you know, if we think we can imagine it or understand it, we're wrong. It's inconceivable. Unimaginable. And there's a real danger that, you know, because that's a bit difficult to take on board, we start sort of focusing on things which are what are called fingers pointing at the moon. They're not the real thing. So it's great, maybe, that for hundreds of years there was no images of the Buddha. This was taken very, very seriously, almost as though there was a prohibition on it. And the Buddha, well, enlightenment, the Buddha, was only ever represented sort of obliquely by other symbols for hundreds and hundreds of years. Even when the great emperor Ashoka sort of unified India and made it a Buddhist kingdom and put up these pillars all over the place, putting forward Buddhist principles, he didn't ever use the image of the Buddha. He used, say, a lion or a wheel. So you got all these images, these symbols which represented enlightenment, which represented the Buddha, but weren't the sort of the body of the Buddha. So a lion, footprints, a pair of footprints, or a footprint. A bull, because apparently the Buddha was regarded as like the leader of mankind in the same way a bull is the leader of a herd of cattle. An empty throne. So this sort of really evocative image of just a throne, but nobody on it, because you can't picture the person that's on it. The wheel of the truth. A flame, or the sun, you know, the sun that all the planets revolve around that gives heat. All of those were used, but no image of the human body of the Buddha. So all those were images, but maybe the biggest and the most important image, I mean, Vajratara says certainly the biggest and the most important image, took me to task about that earlier, symbol for the enlightened mind, was the stupa. What on earth is it? What Buddhists call a stupa. Okay, what are they? Stupas almost certainly originated as simple burial mounds. The way we have in this country, very, you know, in prehistoric times, very, very important people, heroes, great, great leaders, whatever, were buried in under mounds, right? And the Buddha, of course, was regarded as a very, very great being indeed, and no doubt was buried under a mound, or maybe lots of mounds, because maybe the body was split, the ashes were split up. So the Buddha was commemorated in that way. And these stupas, these sort of mounds, these big mounds, became like a focus for people's feeling of reverence and gratitude towards the Buddha. So it's all very well to say, don't make images of the sort of body of flesh and blood of the Buddha. That's all very well. It's all very well to say it's not the body that's important, but reverence seems to be a pretty inescapable part of the way we relate to what's beyond us, to what we can't conceive. It seems to be an integral part of the way we approach what's beyond us and grow towards it. And people need a focus for their reverence, for their feeling of reverence. And the stupa seems to have become this focus in the early days of Buddhism after the Buddha's death. The stupa seems to have become that focus. People would, a great practice was to circumambulate the stupa, to sort of walk around it. So people would walk around the stupa in a clockwise direction, perhaps chanting. with respect, connecting in the open air, connecting with their sense of reverence for the ideal of enlightenment. So stupas started out as this sort of simple burial mound, if you like. But they didn't stay like that. They grew and they developed and they evolved differently in different places. So you've got all sorts of different stupas. And their symbolism seems to have become richer and richer. I'm going to go into just one particular sort of stupa in a while, in a bit of detail, but which has got a lot of symbolism in it. But you see, there's masses of different sorts of stupas. So I mean, I've got a few pictures here. This is a stupa that's in Nepal that a lot of people will come across. You can have a look at these later. Looks a bit like somebody's washing hanging out, doesn't it? It's got this sort of terrifically joyful quality of having all these flags all over it. And it's got eyes. I think that's great. It's got eyes. It's the enlightened mind sort of looking out. And it's huge. It's a very big building. Who's seen it? Yeah, loads of people have seen it, you see. It's a big thing. So that's one sort of stupa that you've got evolving. You've got other sorts of stupas evolving. You've still got sort of simple hemispherical structures. You've got sort of simple hemispherical structures which seem to have loads of umbrellas on the top. One on top of the other. The sort of teams seem to sort of combine a sort of sense of groundedness of the big hemisphere with this sort of upward movement of all these umbrellas one above the other. You've got pagodas. They seem to sort of accentuate this sort of upward movement. Again, developed into pagodas. In Southeast Asia, you've got the most amazing things. I don't know if anyone can see that. You see that? You can pass it around if you like. It's huge. These are people down here. This is a huge golden structure. It's a huge golden structure that towers up into the sky. It's awesome. It's gold. It's illuminated. It's big. It soars. It gives you a sense of awe. It gives you a sense of mystery. It gives you a sense of, a bit like nature, it gives you a sense of, well, I'm not that big. And this is really big and really beautiful. So you've got stupas developing in all these sort of different directions. You've got things like Borobudur in Indonesia, where there is, you probably can't see this either, but a whole hillside. This is a hill, which is in the form of a huge mandala with a big stupa on the top. And I don't know how many stupas underneath it, just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stupas. So you've got this thing evolving in all these different sort of ways. The ones I really love are these huge Southeast Asian ones, great golden monuments like that one. It's on the page that you know that. these things that soar up into the sky, they're absolutely beautiful. And I mean, I was thinking about this talk. I was thinking, well, so what is this about sort of like architecture as a symbol or great monuments as a symbol? These are huge monuments. Huge monuments that work as a symbol. I was thinking, well, yeah, they're often towering. They give us this sense of awe and they give us this sense of upwardness. They're often very grounded feeling, but they have this real sense of upward uplift, especially when they're really big. And I thought, well, in our own culture, we might compare this to, say, cathedrals. These often have a soaring, uplifting quality. They just sort of seem to sort of strain upwards. They're filled with, at their best, if they're not filled with tourists, they're filled with space and silence and shot through with these beams of coloured light from stained glass windows that gradually move as the sun moves. And if we open ourselves up to them, regardless of what we think of Christianity, they can communicate a higher state of mind. They can communicate something. They put us in a state of mind. which is a combination of that spaciousness and that silence and that uplift. And maybe our usual state of mind, by comparison, is a bit more like a suburban sitting room with the TV blaring and the kids arguing and a dog barking. In a room like that, you can't think clearly, you can't see very far, your head is full of distractions and conflict, everything is boring and mundane. So by contrast, a great cathedral symbolises a very different state of mind. It induces a different state of mind. It's a way into a different state of mind, if we let it, if we open up to it. And remembering and imagining that state of mind in meditation can help us. It can help us to contact something in meditation. It can be a way of contacting something in meditation. And for Buddhists, long before the Christian cathedrals were built, stupas seem to have functioned in much the same way. They were symbols. They were centres of reverence. They symbolised a striving for something higher, something growing out of the earth, something great and awe-inspiring and beyond our usual states of mind, certainly not a suburban living room. Unlike cathedrals, it wasn't what went on inside them that was important, because I think they tended to be solid. It wasn't what went on inside them that was important. What was important was what went wrong outside them. People circumambulated them. People expressed their reverence, if you like, outside them. Maybe because the climate was better. Yeah, I mean, if you circumambulate the average cathedral, you might well get wet or snowed upon. If you circumambulate the average stupa, it'll probably be nice and sunny, unless it's the monsoon. So maybe that's one of the reasons. Or maybe it's got to do something to do with a different attitude to nature. Maybe it's got something to do with the fact that Buddhists have more of a reverence for nature than traditional Christianity. I don't know. Maybe people liked being outside, exposed to the elements when they expressed their sense of something higher by walking and circumambulating and chanting. I think a lot of us relate to the sort of elements, the natural elements. They can also give us that sort of sense of space, that sense of awe, that sense of mystery, that sense of wonder, that sense of something beyond our normal sort of concerns. And this sense of the elements became a really important part of the symbolism of the stupa. Invoking, if you like, our experience of the elements, the natural elements, and helping us to use these to sort of integrate our energies, to contact something in ourself that sort of resonated with those elements, in our meditation, became a sort of important part of the symbolism of the stupa. So, in its most, probably its most developed form of the stupa, it used the imagery, it specifically used the imagery of the elements. And it became a meditation practice. It became not just a building, but a meditation practice. It became a way of relating this sort of connection with the natural elements to our meditation. Now, when I say the elements, it uses the imagery of earth, water, fire, and air, so the sort of traditional four elements. Any scientist among you will go, they're not elements. There's 100 odd of them, and they're in a periodic table. Maybe it doesn't mean the same thing as elements. It means the different forms in which matter, energy can come, if you like. So matter, energy, matter, which are the same thing, they're transposable, they come in a solid form. That's earth. That's the solid phase. That's earth. You can't go through it. They come in a liquid form. That's symbolized by water. They come in a gaseous form. That's air. And they come as energy. And that's fire. So earth, water, fire, and air, we can almost forget the way elements. They're the traditional elements. They mean you know, the stuff of which this, whatever it is that we seem to inhabit, seems to be made of. And then there's a fifth one added, which is space, in which they all live. So these states of matter. But it's important to say that I think the people who were doing this meditation, these Buddhists, they had a different attitude to the elements to the one most of us do. They got called, I can't remember the Sanskrit for this, but they could be called as the Maha something or other, the great spirits, Mahabhutas, thank you, which can be translated, I hope, as the great spirits. They're like seen as something living. They're seen as something living, something alive. We have been heavily indoctrinated. It's really difficult for anybody in a particular age to see quite how indoctrinated they've been by the ideas of that age. But we've been heavily indoctrinated by the ideas of our age to think that the world is dead, that matter is dead, that when we go out into nature, it's just this sort of dead thing, and our sense of its beauty and wonder is just something we put into it. We've been heavily indoctrinated like that. But there's another way of seeing things. There's another way of which is much more what most people have seen, the way most people have seen things since throughout history and prehistory, which is to see the world as living. And I think we can get a sense of that in nature. If we go and spend some real time out in nature, we get a sense of the world, a sense of mystery and awe and something in nature which is not just a sort of dead machine. And I mean, this is currently popularized by concepts like Gaia, you know, the idea that the planet itself has a being, the idea that the planet itself is an organism. Why do we have to think that it's just us? You know, suddenly all this dead stuff sort of comes together and produces living beings. It's thoroughly unplausible. Thoroughly unplausible. We live in a living universe. And our depths, if you like, see the world as living. They see the world as a living thing, as full of mystery, even awe. If we make the world a dead machine, we reduce ourselves and we reduce life to something much more boring and machine-like than it needs be. So in this meditation, if you like, in the sense of the stupa, the elements are seen as living, and so is space that surrounds them. The word that's used for space is akasha. And akasha has implications of brightness. So it's some sort of bright element in which this exists, that encloses all the other elements. Not a sort of dead, black hole of space, which is how we tend to think of space. So it's seeing the world in a much more bright, optimistic, mysterious living way, if you like. And maybe this akasha is a bit like consciousness. Maybe it's a bit more like consciousness than space, because it's like it's a conscious universe. Not dark and dead. So it's the elements in this sense that the stupa symbolizes and tries to help us sort of connect with. So in the stupa symbolism, which I'm going to explain the stupa symbolism in a moment, each element represents, if you like, something in our psyche. Each element represents a sort of energy in our psyche, an energy that we can experience in our body and in our mind. It also represents, each energy is also connected, seen as connected with a part of our body, which very roughly you might try and correlate with another sort of set of symbols, which are called the chakras, the sort of energy centers in the body. But there's so many different ways of representing those, we'll probably steer clear of them. But so the symbolism of the stupa, especially if we can use it in meditation practice, can help us to develop, help us to integrate, and help us to refine these different sorts of energy. It can help us to develop them and move them from the coarse to the refined, going from what's stuck and solid to what's free and liberated and blissful, using them in meditation. So the stupa, these monuments become, if you like, a meditation practice. And in this meditation practice, well, it brings in colour, and colour becomes quite important because colour becomes one of the ways we can connect with this sort of feeling that these different energies can give us. So thanks to Vajratara for this piece of artwork. This is a diagrammatical representation of a sort of idealized stupa representing the different elements. So at the bottom, at the very bottom of the stupa, we've got a yellow or golden cube. Yeah? And if we're doing this as a meditation, this is, if you like, it's our base. It's our legs and our pelvis. And it represents the element earth. Earth, matter. Matter in solid form. That stuff. A yellow cube. Or a golden cube. It's already often said yellow. I mean, I quite like gold. Gold is really heavy. It's really heavy, it's really grounded. So it's solid and it's grounded. It also is not going anywhere, which is good, but it might be bad. So that's the sort of base. If we're using this as a meditation practice, that's our base. That's, we imagine that at the level of our hips and our legs, our pelvis. And above that, at the level of our abdomen, we imagine a sphere, a white sphere which represents the element water. This is sort of centered on the abdomen or the navel. So it's got a different character. It's water. It's freer. It's more mobile. It's more playful. It's more maybe full of feeling. But it's still heavy. Yeah, a big sphere of water is going to be really quite heavy. But then above this in the abdomen, so in the chest, if you like, rising up through the neck, you imagine a red cone. And the red cone represents the element fire, energy, symbolized by this red cone. And this has got an upward quality to it. Like flame has got an upward quality to it compared to the heaviness of water below it. It's also warm compared to water, which tends to be a bit damp. So it's this light, upward, warm energy in the chest. And then above this, above the red cone, we have a sort of very pale green, if you like, bowl or crescent, like a crescent moon lying on its back, which you might see at your eye, level of your eyebrows. And this is the element air. This is very fresh. It's expansive. It's like the atmosphere. It's like winds and breezes. It's free and wide. And the colour green is very subtle. You have to imagine it very, very subtle. It communicates that very subtly. And above the bowl of the air, just above the crown of the head, if you like, just above the crown of the head, is the element space, the bright awareness that contains all the others. And that's in the form of a bright, fiery drop, like a drop, shining intensely brightly, scintillating all the different colours of the rainbow, just above the crown of the head. So stupas often bring out this symbolism, the actual sort of brick, stone, papier-mâché, expanded polystyrene stupas that we come across in the FWBO. They bring out this symbolism. But it's also something we can use in meditation. And if we do bring it, if we do use it in meditation, so connect, it has a number of effects. It has this integrating effect where we integrate, we sort of connect with different sort of energies in the body, if you like, and integrate them. It puts us in touch with different parts of the bodies. At the extremes, it combines sort of that groundedness of the earth with a sort of uplift of the fire and the expansiveness of the air and the sort of just brilliance of the subtle drop, the scintillating drop. And it can also have the effect of helping us to sort of refine our energies, put us in touch with the process of refining our energies. So we start with earth. Well, okay, earth is necessary. Groundedness is necessary. But on its own, it's stuck. It's solid. It's not free. It's like someone who's over-controlled, not in touch with their emotions, or their energy's blocked. It's like someone whose energies are blocked. It's not going anywhere. There's no available energy. At the next level, water, well, there's more freedom. It's like being more in touch with the emotions, more free, but it's a bit soggy. It's heavy. It can't rise far. It's sort of freed up, but it can't rise far. But then the next level up, fire, is all about rising. It's all about rising. It's about upward energy. And it's anything but damp. So this is a step up in freedom. It's a bit more refined. It's a bit more upward moving. It's a bit freer. And then we get to air. And air has this sense of infinite expansion, infinite freedom, freshness. And then finally space, akasha, infinity itself, consciousness itself, freed consciousness itself, free, blissful, playful, sparkling, scintillating, shining every colour of the rainbow. So the meditation can not only help us integrate all these energies, it can also symbolise the way we move from relatively stuck energy to blissful, freed, playful, infinite, if you like, energy. Stupas are these monumental symbols, of a higher state, which I compared to cathedrals. And we've probably all got experience of buildings, perhaps cathedrals don't do it for you, but we've almost probably all got experience of buildings or monuments which put us in touch with something. Sense of awe, sense of wonder, a sense of something beyond ourselves, a sense of being part of something beyond ourselves, a sense of uplift, a sense of infinity, a sense of something. You know, words sort of don't work that well. Buildings actually work better. Really great buildings work better than words. Really great monuments. And then the elements can do that. The other place that this happens is nature. Very often, you know, our experience of nature gives us a sense of something. We connect with higher states of mind. We connect with states of mind that aren't like a suburban living room. Yeah? We spend all too much of our time in states of mind in suburban living rooms and in states of mind that are like suburban living rooms where you can't see very far and where it's all too and a bit sort of tacky and the carpet needs sweeping. So it's no coincidence that stupas use that sort of imagery of the natural elements. For many of us, that's nature is the most powerful way of connecting with a sense of something beyond ourselves, a sense of awe. Something beyond our own little concerns. And all of this we can use in our meditation. We've seen how we can use stupas in our meditation. I said, you know, you could use, what does it feel like to go into a great cathedral? You could use that as a way of connecting with something in meditation. But we've all got to have our own experiences. So what I'd like you to think about, is where in my past, what has done it for me in that way? What buildings, places, situations, places in nature, experiences have done it for me in that way. I mean, I remember being out in the middle of a channel, of the channel on a brightly moonlit night, the only person on deck on a small sailing boat. And I mean, that was just, you know, it was just amazing. And you'll all have experiences like that. So what does it for you? What puts you in touch with something which you could then recall and use in your meditation? You could bring that into your meditation to reconnect with that sense of a higher state of mind. You could quite consciously do that.